From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. Iran announced today that it could breach its commitment to the 2015 nuclear deal in 10 days. That is, if European countries are not able to get to the U.S. to lift the sanctions Washington reimposed on Iran. According to the Iranian government, its stockpile of enriched uranium could exceed the limit allowed as of June 27th. The U.S. has vowed to increase pressure on Iran. We're joined by NPR senior editor and Washington correspondent Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Hello, Lisa.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the U.S. doesn't want war with Iran, but it is considering a full range of options. He also insists that it was Iran that bombed two oil tankers in the Persian Gulf last week. How has this conflict been playing out in the region and with U.S. allies? Because U.S. and its friends in Europe are not in lockstep on this.
No, Lisa, they are not. And this crisis has the region on edge and U.S. allies urging maximum restraint. That's their language. Iran is locked in an intense rivalry here with some of its immediate neighbors around the Persian Gulf, countries that use that Gulf and the Gulf of Oman to ship the oil. That's their economic lifeblood. The United States does not depend on that oil as we once did, but other parts of the world do. And those other parts of the world want all the hostile parties to back down and back off. And that includes the United States with its tough sanctions on Iran.
The president himself, though, doesn't sound quite as hawkish as his advisors. I wonder how much attention you believe he's been giving to Iran in recent days.
It's possible that in recent days he's given more attention to George Stephanopoulos, spending 30 hours with the ABC anchor last week for a TV special aired last night. Now, we know that John Bolton, the president's national security advisor, sees this moment as an opportunity to squeeze Iran and force our allies to choose sides and back us. But the president himself has lots of other things on his mind, including his official re-election campaign launch, which is tomorrow night in Orlando, Florida.
Well, you mentioned the Stephanopoulos interview. ABC released more of its recent interview with the president. Mr. Trump has insisted he did not try to get special counsel Robert Mueller fired, despite accounts that he had called the White House counsel multiple times to do just that. Let's listen.
I wasn't going to fire. You know why? Because I watched Richard Nixon go around firing everybody, and that didn't work out too well.
The president there invoking Richard Nixon. What do you make of the exchange and this revealing series of interviews as a whole?
Well, starting just with that exchange, the president clearly did not want to personally fire Mueller, but he tried to get others to get rid of Mueller for him. That's from sworn testimony contained in the Mueller report. George Stephanopoulos at one point asked the president if he had read the report, and the president said, oh, yes, of course. Yes, of course I have. Have you? George Stephanopoulos said, yes, I read every word. We know from the White House counsel, Don McGahn, and his testimony to Robert Mueller, and this is in the report, that the president had come in and twice indicated that he wanted someone, perhaps Attorney General at that time, Jeff Sessions, to get rid of Mueller.
The president, as you know, Ron, kicks off his 2020 campaign officially tomorrow, and he is claiming in the meantime that leaked polls that were done by his own campaign showed him at a disadvantage against Joe Biden and that those polls were fake. Now, reports indicate that the Trump campaign is clamping down on its own pollsters. What do you make of all of this?
Well, three pollsters have left the campaign. These were people who had worked for him in 2016. When you get a bad set of polls, your problem may not be the people who did the poll. And firing them is not a good look. It's like firing your personal physician for telling you you've got high blood pressure. In this particular instance, the president can say that in March, maybe these polls didn't look so good, but that since then, with what's happened with the Mueller report and the summary of it that we got from Attorney General Barr, things are actually looking better. And that as people take a long look at the Democratic candidates, Donald Trump is looking better. So that's the White House line at this point, is that March might have been bad, but now things are going fine. But if you look at the polls that are coming from news organizations and news organizations like CNN and also Wall Street Journal, NBC, and also Fox News, they all show double-digit leads for Joe Biden in theoretical matchups for 2020. And that's pretty tough if you're about to launch your campaign tomorrow night.
One other hot domestic issue I want to ask you about, Ron, before we let you go. The Supreme Court released decisions today. Liberals Sotomayor, Kagan, Ginsburg joined conservatives Thomas and Gorsuch about a ruling about racial gerrymandering. What was that ruling consisting of?
Yes, an unusual majority. Sometimes the court rules without really addressing the key issues or the underlying arguments in a case. The court rules instead on the propriety of the procedure by which the case has been appealed, or perhaps the standing of the parties. And we've seen this in some big cases where the court says that the side bringing the appeal does not really have the proper standing. In this particular case, it came from Virginia, where the voting districts were thrown out because they disadvantaged minority voters. The legislature redrew the maps that are now in effect. But part of the legislature wasn't happy with that remapping, and the Republican-controlled chamber of the state legislature tried to have that overturned. And today the Supreme Court said, no, you don't get another kick at the cat.
I just want to ask you one other thing about the Supreme Court decision. It ordered Oregon's Court of Appeals to take up the case of a baker in Oregon. The baker refused to make a wedding cake for a same-sex couple. The Oregon court had ruled in favor of the couple. Now, in light of the Supreme Court decision, what could happen?
Well, the Oregon courts are going to weigh back in, and we'll have at least one ruling from those courts. And whatever they rule could be in favor of the baker, could be in favor of the couple. Whoever comes out ahead in the Oregon courts is probably going to have that case appealed. The losers are going to appeal the case back into the federal system, and we could reach the Supreme Court with that one again.
Good to talk to you as always. NPR senior editor and Washington correspondent Ron Elving. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa.
Well, we are now nearly 3 weeks into the Atlantic hurricane season, and so far, no storms. But the powerful hurricanes of past years, along with a boom in development, have hammered the shrimping industry in parts of South Carolina, places where you can still hear snatches of the Gullah language spoken by descendants of the slaves who once labored in the fields and on the docks. Eileen LeBlanc found one shrimper off the coast of the Sea Islands who's preparing to hang up his nets.
The last boat is coming in today as the sun is getting low. Only 3 boats come in with their catch these days, but there used to be over 20 boats tying up at the docks, including the 4 girls named for the children of Captain Robert Pope.
You just caught big shrimp, pretty shrimp. Go look in and look at it.
The catch is pretty good today, maybe 500 to 600 pounds.
The shrimp got pretty big over here for a while, but it's slowly going away.
Charles Gay and his family own the Gay Fish Company of Frogmore, South Carolina. His family has been trawling these waters since 1948, and Marty Curran and her family have been buying shrimp almost as long.
My mother and Mrs. Gay, she would sit on a stool, maybe that stool right there, and check us out. And they would just talk.
So Curran's upset by the for sale sign down by the dirt road entrance.
And I'm hoping a miracle will take place and somebody would come in and buy it and keep it going.
Miracles have happened before. After recent hurricanes trashed the docks, the community raised money and a good portion of the docks were rebuilt by volunteers with donated lumber. But it wasn't enough.
Even when we were in our heyday, we could not produce enough to fight it.
The it Charles Gay refers to is imported shrimp. Even here in South Carolina, in restaurants just a frisbee toss to the Atlantic, you may eat shrimp from such Asian countries as Indonesia.
The imports started controlling the price of the shrimp. If you're getting $3 for your shrimp and you're paying $3.50 for fuel and you still got to pay a crew member, you tear a net up, you blow an engine up, you might as well just throw the towel in and go home.
Charles Gay started shrimping here with his father. And when the boy asked, how long are we going to shrimp today? The answer was always, can see to can't see. Or from first light in the morning until it's too dark to trawl anymore.
Hey, how's it going, Jack?
All right. Hey, how you?
Gay greets Dakota Merck, a biologist with the South Carolina Department of Natural Resources.
So right now I am seeing what size these shrimp are that he just recently caught. And I'm checking to see the species as well. We do this to try to get a better idea of the forecast for the upcoming season for any kind of commercial shrimping.
The state controls the season and closes waters that are not healthy, such as after a storm when runoff is bad. And runoff has gotten worse with all the development on the coast. Charles Gay points to the next barrier island over.
Barrier islands, that's what they are. When I was a little boy, Harbor Island was nothing but a big beach with some little old myrtle bushes that big on it. Look at it now.
Condos, golf courses, beach villas. But the good life has not been so good for the environment. Add to that vacationers and sport fishermen.
They don't carry any trash cans with them. They don't carry a porta potty with them. And I'm not trying to be nasty by any means. But go out there and drink beer for 8 or 9 hours and throw a cast net. I need to say more?
Charles Gay says it's over for him, though he still seems to have fun every day. He has a large family and a grandson studying business who would love to take over the company.
I don't want him to.
Why?
It's too hard a life. You don't ever know from day to day what you're going to have tomorrow. It's not here anymore. And I think it's going to take several generations before it ever comes back. If it comes back at all, because of the population growth and the changes in the climate and all of that.
So the sale sign stands at the end of the dirt road, next to the flag waving open, for now.
Hello.
Hi.
Good. For NPR News, I'm Eileen LeBlanc in Beaufort, South Carolina.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Emberwave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat. Ever wish feeling too hot or too cold were optional? As summer heats up outside, just press for a thermal wave designed to provide cooling relief. Over-air-conditioned inside? Leave that sweater in the car and rely on Emberwave instead. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Emberwave, control your comfort. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross says President Trump would be, quote, perfectly happy to raise tariffs on more Chinese goods if the U.S. and China can't strike a deal. Meanwhile, the Chinese government is stepping up its support for the leader of Hong Kong. The head of Hong Kong is pro-Beijing. She is dealing with massive protests in Hong Kong and a deepening political crisis. These events are making for a tough time for China's president, Xi Jinping. He's also dealing with a slowing economy and other threats to China's regional dominance. Our next guest is someone whose job it is to communicate the Chinese perspective on issues like these to an English-language audience around the world. Liu Xin is an anchor on the China Global Television Networks, the international arm of the state-owned China Central Television. Many Americans were introduced to Liu last month when Fox Business host Trish Regan had her on for a primetime debate about the ongoing trade war. Liu Xin spoke with Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd last week. He asked her if she was surprised by how much attention the Fox Business debate received.
Well, you know, it was the very first time that a news presenter, a journalist from the national broadcaster, appear on such a high-profile occasion on a major U.S. Media TV organization. So it got really a lot of attention. And looking back, people here, especially in China, they were just dissecting every syllable that I was uttering, you know, so it was really much more attention than I would have thought. Yeah, but I think I did okay. I think people were reasonably satisfied, so that was fine.
Well, the big topic, of course, was the trade war between the United States and China. So let's talk a little bit about that ourselves. Where do you think this is going? The latest news out of the United States is that President Trump says that if he doesn't meet with Xi Jinping, the Chinese president, at the G20 summit in Japan later this month, that he's just going to ratchet up the tariffs even more than he already has. What are the chances that this resolves itself?
Well, just from the way the invitation or the challenge is issued in public with such, you know, with some kind of a negative consequence attached, it really doesn't bode very well. But I think at this moment, we really do need to cool down both sides, especially the United States, you know, not to give this kind of public threats. I think China is trying its best to keep cool, but it's also getting ready for a protracted period of trouble. And I think over the past few months, the Chinese people have already started to get used to the idea that, you know, if the United States really wants to have a trade war with us, then we have to stand our ground. So then I think we're more or less prepared.
Well, and what would that mean? A protracted trade war with the United States. How much would it hurt China's economy?
Well, I think China has its estimates, and we just talked about it the other day in our show, and one of the experts talked about maybe about 0.5 percentage point of our GDP could possibly be shaved off during this year, for this year's target, and China's GDP is about $13 trillion, according to international estimates. So they have some kind of an idea, but you know, at the end of the day, I think the Chinese people and the Chinese leadership have the confidence that time is on our side.
But do you agree with with at least the consensus by economists here in the United States that say China has more to lose than the United States and that China has less leverage in these negotiations simply because the size of the U.S. economy is so much bigger and China needs U.S. goods more than the other way around.
Well, if you talk about the size of the Chinese market, I guess the U.S. probably needs China much more. We're talking about a country of 1.4 billion people. That's three times the size of the U.S. population. And let's not forget, it is there is a big middle class that is hugely hungry for quality goods, quality services from everywhere around the world. And here, our understanding is that the United States probably stand to lose more. At the end of the day, if the trade war drags on, this is going to be hurting for both economies. Whether China hurts more or the United States hurts more, there will be other economies getting hurt as well. The world's economic growth will be hurt as well. So is that what we are going to see? I hope not.
I want to talk to you about your own professional life. You are, as we've said, a high-profile TV anchor for CGTN. You've got this very interesting job of communicating the Chinese perspective to English language viewers and now, in this case, listeners around the world in the United States. But as you well know, your network has been described as a mouthpiece of the Communist Party. I'm just curious how you handle that and how much influence does the party have on your reporting?
You know, this is not the first time that I hear this, and there are all kinds of ways to put a label on what we do and then try to discredit what we do. I have been working with the national broadcaster since I graduated from university back in 1997, and I've always found this job fascinating and challenging and gratifying because I always try to measure my work from a simple professional perspective, whether I'm following the facts, whether I'm giving the full picture, whether I'm being fair, whether I'm being accurate, whether I'm being interesting, engaging, even entertaining, because we're doing TV. I really don't care what people call me. I just try to do a better job every day.
Sure. And I'm sure you know that people listening to this will immediately be skeptical of what you're saying for these reasons. The Justice Department here in the U.S. required the network to register as a foreign agent, which essentially labels the network as a lobbying firm to try to influence public opinion. Is that right? Is CGTN a foreign agent?
Well, if you ask me, I definitely don't think so. As I said, I see myself as a journalist, just as any other journalist around the world. And I think it is in the interests of the viewers to have this perspective, which has been missing in the big picture. You know, you have been getting information from American TV or from international TV about China, most of the time talked about from a foreign journalist perspective, or I don't know. But, you know, to get an information, authentic information coming out of China, I think there's a certain value to it. And I don't understand why people would just, you know, discredit and try to put a label on it. And I think it's in their own loss.
Well, on one story that I know is of great interest around the world is what's happening with the Uyghurs, the minority Muslims in northwest China. The U.S. and other countries have condemned the detention of up to a million of them in that region. How have you reported on that situation?
Well, we talked about it. We've had discussions actually quite a few times with guests both from China and from Turkey. And we had studio discussions on this subject. And we talked about what are the reasons why the Chinese government decided to take these measures and what have been the effect of these measures. By the way, that number you just cited, I think it is not very accurate. I never saw in any official reports any number so significant being cited. Anyway, I think it is a big challenge for China to tackle domestic terrorism, just as it is in the United States. And there is no textbook to follow. There is no playbook to follow here. So what is being done is through education, through vocational education, through teaching people the laws and the languages of their country to help them, you know, support themselves and de-radicalize.
Well, that is what the Chinese government is saying. They're countering these reports from Western news organizations and from human rights groups in the United Nations that says the government is saying the camps are vocational training, just like you do it, that they're trying to prevent extremism. But there are also but there's also examples of mosques being torn down and, you know, facial recognition being used to detain people. So do you see no religious repression against Muslim minorities in Western China?
Well, from what I understood, from what I read, and again, I've never been to the Uyghur Autonomous Region, so I cannot tell you that I've seen this, but I've seen numbers pointing to the kind of religious facilities that are made available to the people there. For instance, I understand in the Xinjiang Autonomous Region, there are one mosque for every 500 worshippers. That is even more than some Muslim majority countries such as Turkey. So I do not know where the kind of evidence comes from saying that people are forbidden to follow their normal religious activities. I do not know. And there are foreign tourists going to Xinjiang, by the way. They can see for themselves.
I'm citing a report, an investigation by The Guardian that says 24 Islamic religious sites have been partly or completely demolished by the government. So that's where that information came from. But the point is, I guess, what you're trying to say and what I'm trying to say is that there is a misunderstanding for sure between at least our two governments. Would you think that's fair to say?
I think there is a great gap in information. There is a great deficit in understanding between the two sides, between the two governments, and especially between the two peoples. That's why I say the trade deficit is huge, but it's not the source of the problem. The biggest problem we have today is that we on the Chinese side are much more curious, much more open-minded, much better informed about what's happening in your country than the other way around. I think on the Chinese side, there is a great curiosity about Western culture, about Western science and technology development as well. So there is the hunger, there is a sponge on our side. And then for the United States, you have to tell me, Peter, why people are not so curious. Maybe they're just generally not so interested about what's happening outside their immediate borders. I don't know. Maybe your life is too comfortable, or when everybody is speaking English, probably you don't find it necessary to speak anyone else's language. Yeah, maybe there are other factors. I don't know.
That's Lu Xin, anchor for the China Global Television Network. She hosts the opinion show The Point on weekdays at CGTN. Thank you so much for speaking with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you.
Fed officials are gathering for a two-day policy meeting starting tomorrow where they'll decide whether to cut interest rates or keep them where they are. The Federal Reserve is under mounting pressure to act as trade tensions between the U.S. and China continue. Let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So there's been a lot of pressure mounting for the Fed chair, Jerome Powell, to react to some slowdown in the economy, including the slower job growth in May. Earlier this month, he said the Fed would act as appropriate to sustain the economic expansion with a strong labor market and inflation near that 2% objective. Is the Fed, as you see it right now, likely to decide to cut interest rates?
I think the odds are that they're going to cut, but not at this meeting particularly. Right now, we're looking at maybe a 20% chance of a rate cut this time around. And I should add to your description of the economy slowing down, again, that inflation target seems to be a very big deal, because we got some information last week that showed that inflation, as the way the Fed measures it, is really falling short. They're targeting, as you said, 2.2%. It's down at 1.6%. So I think that both sides argue for a rate cut. Not sure it'll happen this time.
And the other thing is that as you look at least the stock market, which is, of course, not the economy, but one measure of what's going on, it seems to go up and down with whatever happens with the trade war with China. And, one wonders whether the Fed ought to wait until there either is or isn't a trade deal with China to decide what to do.
Well, that's the argument, I think, for waiting until July, that you'll get one more month worth of data, but you'll also see what happens at the G20 summit that occurs at the end of this month. Maybe President Xi and President Trump sneak off into a corner and decide, hey, you know what? This trade stuff, bad for both of us. Let's try to get the talks back on track. So that might be an argument for the July meeting. Wait till we see whether or not we have any escalation or de-escalation of the trade war with China.
Meanwhile, speaking of the trade war with China, this week companies are testifying before the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative about new tariffs on Chinese goods. What are you expecting there? Or could these hearings have any impact?
Well, this is about yet another round of tariffs on about $300 billion worth of Chinese goods that have not yet seen any tariffs. Now, this would be much more far-ranging. It would include all sorts of devices like your phones and your laptops, clothing. And I think these businesses are really worried about this next round. We know that retailers have gone directly to the White House to say, this could be devastating for us. This is exactly the moment where we're buying for the holiday season. Please, please, please don't do it. Then again, they've said this before, and the president has moved forward. So I just don't know how effective it's going to be. Maybe this time it will. Maybe not.
Have you noticed any differences in prices because of the trade war in general?
I have not particularly in my life, but I think part of the problem that we all have is that we have so many different price points of different items in our lives. They all kind of merge together. Mm-hmm. So overall, I think that the fact that inflation is running a little bit tepid helps the argument that it's not that big a deal in most Americans' lives.
Sounds like your dogs have noticed some changes.
Yes, they're very upset about their dog food, indeed.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News. Thank you.
Take care.
Okay, well, today we're going to do something a little different, a dance hall edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
Just touched down in the airport. Mm-hmm. Track suit, I'm an Air Force.
Mm-hmm. I take the shot and wine, wine, wine. I wine, wine.
We're finally ready. Me not tell you from who was a child, me ready. The God won't miss every same.
Omar Phillips is a dance hall DJ who is part of the sound system Jock Cuban. He's going to explain what that is in a second. But first, Omar, welcome to Here and Now.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so you are originally from Brooklyn. Your parents are Panamanian. How did you get into dance hall music, which is from Jamaica?
So the section of Brooklyn that I live in is Crown Heights, probably the highest concentration of West Indians, I think, in the Northern Hemisphere. So pretty much every time I walked out my house, the 9 out of 10 people, sometimes even 10 out of 10 that I've meet was either from Trinidad, Jamaica, Haiti, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So trying to find just American culture in my community for the first upteenth years of my life was almost impossible.
And we said that you're part of a sound system called Ja Cuban. That is an essential part of reggae culture from which dancehall is derived. Explain what a sound system, first of all, originally was in Jamaica.
It's an evolution, right? So in the beginning, to explain sound system, you would think the literal terms, okay? We think of speakers and turntables. Mm-hmm. But in turn, it was almost like teams, right? You have team A. So let's say Jack Cuban in a sense. Well, we had different people that had different jobs. So you have the person that actually – the team that will actually bring the equipment out, set it up. You had the MC that kind of was just that. It was just an MC, got the crowd involved and introduced the songs. And you had what we call a selector, which, you know, made sure the playlist, the records were in order, made sure we had the party going and reading the vibes and playing it. So all encompassing, it's a sound system.
Okay, well, finally, let's get to some of the music that you have brought us today. The first one is called Dollivan. This is by Busy Signal.
On the food for the basket. Big up every Dollivan. Every Trinidad, Jamaican, Lucian, Guyanese, and African. Get a youth, touch the road with a dollar plan. Van load pan Utica, flat bush a hoop picker. Big up every dollar van. This a busy with a another one. Yeah, music a bums from the phone or the CD. Touch road, touch road.
Now, a dollar van, which is what he's talking about there, is something that exists in New York, in Brooklyn and Queens. This is, it's kind of like an unofficial Uber in a way. They pick up passengers for a dollar.
Precisely, exactly. So growing up, the funny thing was in the Flatbush section of Brooklyn, where I pretty much spent a lot of my time, that exactly what you just said, and the culture that Caribbean people brought with the dollar van, it was kind of like driving down, they'll have a, hey, look, we're in a church group, so if we get pulled over, we're a part of this church group. and this is something that was, you know, was big for the community that we're talking about here, was kind of like poverty going into middle class. So, you know, something as simple as a dollar to get a ride all the way up and down the avenue, travel with my grandmother, these things made a difference. And it was a culture that was brought from the Caribbean of, you know, ways to make money, ways to make life easier, and everybody working. And that's one of the key pieces that I brought this song into the realm for, is because some of the greatest songs in life are just the most simple topics, you know?
And does the dancehall music coming out of New York sound different than the dancehall music coming out of Jamaica?
Well, that's a good question. I'd say no. I'd say we have our own flair, but at the end of the day, dancehall is dancehall. We work off of the biggest producers who, you know, so for instance, the way a song is produced in Jamaica, a producer will kind of create a beat. So let's say in the terms of Michael Jackson, let's say Quincy Jones made Thriller. In America, we will most likely say, okay, that's Michael Jackson's track. If Quincy Jones made Thriller in Jamaica, chances are he will call it, hey, the Thriller rhythm, and he will get Michael Jackson, Prince, Stevie Wonder, and he'll put a slew of artists on that rhythm. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the cream rises to the top, you know, so the biggest songs become the most popular in dancehall. So in that term, you get whatever's good, and then the music will kind of sound the same across the board.
Okay, the next one that you brought us is, and I'm going to try to say this right, Nomad Ova Nogyal. How did I do?
Perfect.
Okay, good.
Perfect,
and this is
perfect.
By Munga on a Rebel. Here it is.
Me no wanna girl a pressure me as me wake. Like oh, my real love get a headache. Better if you give me a break. Cause a boy like me no mad. No. Me no mad over no girl. Cause a boy like we no mad. No. We no mad over no girl. She coulda put it like Dale and spend enough money. No. We no mad over no girl. She coulda cute like Dale and win a box bunny. No.
So, for people who did not get the translation there, Na Mad Over No Gal is, I'm not mad over no gal, okay? It's not that
exactly.
Hard, I guess, right? But this is Patois, exactly. Which is the Creole language of Jamaica, which is a mix of English and various African dialects. Tell us more about this one.
So this one, it's kind of like for a DJ, where it's a bit braggadocious. The thing about dancehall, I think more than any other genre of music, is that we're into the direct effect, right? So we're into playing a song and you reacting. The next song, I want you to react even more wild. So Namad Ova No Gyal, it's for the guys to kind of get a moment to have some machismo, to kind of walk out and say, yeah, no matter how pretty you are, I'm one of those guys that I'm not going to go crazy over you. I mean, chances are they probably go home and go crazy over the same girl, but at least we like to think that machismo is there for a second. But, you know, it's an anthem for the guys to walk out. The ladies have the same kind of anthems, and, you know, and we play them.
And do you speak Patois, by the way?
Yes. So my first language is English, second is Spanish, and then being in that streets of Brooklyn, I have to learn off to speak Patois and learn off it, you know, the road call, so...
Wow.
You know, I could turn it on and turn it off, as in, you know.
How when do you turn it on?
On two different occasions. I turn it on when I'm my Omar is my personal, and then Steelfinger is my DJ name. When I'm Steelfinger, I'm almost always speaking Patois. If I'm trying to keep sharp on it, because it's not something that I know from grandma and grandpa, if I'm with some of my island friends, I'll kind of turn it on to kind of keep sharp at it and keep, you know, good. Because as a Hispanic, you know, it's kind of like, I'm always looked at side-eyed, you know, like, hey, what are you doing speaking that? But, if I'm in a dancehall event or whatever.
Okay, let's get to the next one you brought us. This is Enemies by Mavado.
When enemies are make nice, we no hear the sound. And of them make me wait not the morning, so home if you lose a pound. Cut off all of me enemies, them. All of me enemies, them. Cause them claims them no need me, but we no need them. So me cut all of me enemies them. All of me enemies them. Cause them claims that them a lead, but we a lead them. Jump on the and pretend like you're them.
So tell us more about this one.
So with this one, I guess you could say, is very synonymous with hardcore rap or gangster rap, in a sense where we kind of not speaking the most happiest thing. We're not talking about girls. We're not talking about partying. We're talking more so about enemies and those sorts.
But there are a lot of people who believe that dancehall has gotten much more violent and misogynistic compared to some of the classic reggae like Bob Marley.
Yes, and that's the difference. You hit it on the head. When you talk about reggae, reggae is more based towards consciousness, more roots, more music with a message. It's more universal, I guess, in that sense. Well, dancehall is a little bit more hard to swallow because this is coming directly from the ghettos. And then plus, we're in a culture now, it's like shock value, right? So whatever has the biggest ooh and ah, you know, going to get these kids out of situations, they may just tend or gravitate towards to kind of get out of those situations. And if that sells, then that sells.
Okay, let's listen next to Life. This is by Christopher Martin.
Star road, tell me no lane, no dancing. Highest grade up in the raw, when we blazing. Penny pon the rocks, car we no do no chasing. Tell us we ready now. But life is the most expensive thing. I tell you, life. Everything else cheap ones you can buy, but life is the most expensive thing. I tell you, life. But everything is cheap, cheap, cheap.
More of a positive dancehall song here.
Yes. So with Christopher Martin, one of the reasons that I picked the song in particular was the positive aspect is, once again, it's a direct impact in a dancehall. So if I'm in a dancehall and I get on the microphone and it's full of people and they have liquor and they're feeling good, and I said, everybody will love life, put up some hands, you know, and they're going to put their hands up and I play a song like Life that's directly impacting what my MC just said on the sound system, I'm going to get a huge forward, because everybody who doesn't love life, you know, the few people that don't, but everybody that's in a party atmosphere, chances are they're going to put up a drink or do whatever I asked him to do to celebrate the song.
That is Omar Phillips, who is a dancehall DJ with the sound system Ja Cuban. You can listen to them on Fridays from 9 to 11 p.m. at saw1radio.com. Omar, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for the invite. It was a pleasure.
And before you leave, give me just another sentence in Patois.
I appreciate everybody in the NPR while giving me the opportunity to come out here and speak about the culture for the people. You see me?
Love it. Omar, thank you.
Thank you very much. Have a great one.
And if you want to hear more, you can go to our Spotify playlist. We're at NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
The first democratically elected president of Egypt is dead. Egyptian state television reports a Mohamed Morsi collapsed in court today, where he was on trial for espionage. Morsi was elected after the Arab Spring led to the ouster of Egypt's longtime leader Hosni Mubarak. That was in 2011. But Morsi, who represented the now outlawed Muslim Brotherhood, was himself ousted by the Egyptian army in 2013. Thanasi Kambanis is a journalist and author who covered the Arab Spring. He is now senior fellow at the Century Foundation. Thanasi, welcome back to Here and Now.
Good to be with you.
So this is very sudden. What are your first thoughts on hearing that Mohamed Morsi is dead?
Well, it's not surprising. He was unseated by the army in a coup, and he's been held in solitary confinement almost continuously since then. His family was only allowed to visit him three times in the last 6 years, and his health problems were well documented. There was a lot of belief that the state wanted him to die before they would have to execute him. And it seems like, this is one of these cases of enforced illness or, you know, mistreatment that leads to a premature death.
And apparently there are going to be investigations. They say that there were no obvious injuries on his body, obviously externally anyway. Mohamed Morsi was only president of Egypt for about a year, but it was a really crucial time. I wonder if you would remind us about the state of Egypt, an important U.S. ally, where it was at that time that he assumed power.
So Mohamed Morsi was the first democratically elected president of Egypt, but he himself was not a particularly democratic leader, and he was elected in a split vote. A lot of the secular revolutionaries supported him reluctantly, only because his opponent was also a military general who seemed like a dictator in the making. So he came in as a compromise candidate, and a lot of people expected that he would be a sort of Nelson Mandela figure, bridging Islamists and secularists who opposed Hosni Mubarak's dictatorship. But instead, he ruled himself in a quite authoritarian fashion, and within months alienated almost all his supporters except for the hardest core Islamists. And that year was a very depressing year for people who followed Egypt, because it began with a huge amount of hope by summer of 2012 when he was elected, people thought the military had been overturned and this country was on the path to inventing its own new path to democracy after decades of authoritarianism. But by the end of the year, we had this awful scene of huge crowds cheering a military coup that was branded as a sort of secular salvation coup to unseat Morsi's government, which in its conduct was homophobic, discriminatory, sort of Islamo-supremacist, and did a lot of things that made people afraid that it would be the last election the country would see.
And when he was determined to be a failure as president and ushered out, was he destined to fail given the way that Egypt was so violently split after the Arab Spring movement?
Well, it's hard to figure out who to blame more. I mean, ultimately the biggest culprit in Egypt is the military, which did the dictatorship. But he had a unique chance because he came from this Islamist movement and because he came in at a time when working class people and rich people were united, secularists and Islamists, and so on. It's hard to see how he could have done a great job, but it's really possible to imagine him having done a decent job. And unfortunately, what's happened now is his martyrdom effectively has papered over the mistakes that the revolutionaries and the Muslim Brothers made in that period. So now, once again, we see all the grave sins and errors of Sisi's dictatorship, also problematic role that revolutionaries and would-be reformers played. And so my fear is that if and when there's another crisis point or another uprising, we'll see a lot of these same mistakes repeated by whoever tries to come next.
Yeah, when you're talking about Sisi, you're talking about Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, former general who's now Egypt's president. The Muslim Brotherhood itself, does it still have support in Egypt?
Well, the underground movement, it's been driven completely underground, and part of it has moved into a militant direction, and they've been blamed for a lot of bombings and attacks against the Egyptian state. And then there's a lot of more moderate Muslim Brothers in exile who continue to sort of have a would-be government in exile. It's hard to gauge their public support, but I think a lot of people who were their soft supporters have actually moved away from the Brotherhood and towards other also now outlawed opposition groups like Abdelmonem Aboulfoutou, who famously quit the Brotherhood and founded his own sort of Islamic flavored but independent reform movement. And he also was in prison and denied medication and visitation, just like Morsi. And one point we should note is that all the opposition leaders, from the most peaceful to the most violent, from the most secular to the most religious, have been imprisoned on trumped-up charges and treated, subjected to the same kind of harsh treatment that's led to Morsi's death. And that is clearly the goal of the Egyptian government, is to silence all dissenting voices.
Thanasi Kambanis is senior fellow at the Century Foundation and author of the book Once Upon a Revolution, An Egyptian Story. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.